banana Hannah.
Hannah.
Try the salami Tommy.
Oh, Tommy.
Here with the gravy Davy.
Davy.
Everybody eats when they come to my house. Have a tomato Plato.
Plato.
Here's catch Tora Dora.
Oh, Dora.
Try the bologna Tony.
Hey, Tony.
Everybody eats when they come to my house. I'll fix it.
Welcome to Say Yes to the Chef. Our guest today is Sherry Castle. She's a cookbook author, a cooking instructor, and a Southern food expert. I'm Chef Janice Escott. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, I'm Chef Kelly Taylor. How are you today?
I'm just great today. Welcome back, Sherry.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Oh, we're delighted to have you. There's so much to talk about when you're on the air with us.
You're a busy gal.
Busy. Really
busy. And this is so much fun to do.
So how did you get started? Just a little summary of how you got started in this food world that you are in.
Well, it was a combination of things. I will say it was never a plan, but in hindsight, it was inevitable. I have always loved to cook. I wrote my first original recipe and mailed it to a TV show when I was 4 years old. But my life goal was to be a writer. When I left my hometown of Boone, North Carolina, in Watauga County, up in the beautiful mountains, my intention was to come down and get a PhD in English, become a professor who wrote short stories and novels. That didn't pan out so much, but I have always worked as a professional writer in some capacity in a number of different fields. And so I would earn my living as a writer, but I earned my soul by cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And was kind of known as the person in the office as, like, oh boy, she's the really good cook. Let's make sure we see what she brought to the company party or whatever. And then my last corporate job, I was working for IBM as a writer. And I had my daughter in the 90s. And at that point, IBM was transitioning and paying people to quit their jobs. I've often said, if I could just, you know, quit a job like that every few years, I'd be in good shape. I'd be set. Right. But part of the transition package was education money. And I started taking professional cooking courses out in California to sort of test my own mettle, to cooperate and bolster what I knew. And I did all this with the intention of being a cooking teacher. That's what I wanted to do. Not a restaurateur, not a writer, a cooking teacher, which I did exclusively for the first few years. A woman came to one of my classes one time on a Sunday, and the next day she called me and said, have you ever done any writing? I work for a such-and-such publication, and we would love for you to write a piece. And I said, well, yes, in fact, I have, and I wrote that piece. And based on that alone, they offered me a column. I was too naive to know how unlikely that was to get a column based on one piece. Mm-hmm. But I did that, and over time, the writing kept just popping up and popping up and popping up, and I finally stopped resisting it and embraced it and realized if I'm lucky enough to have two things I like to do instead of only one, I should do it. And I would say that the proportion of how I spent my time from teaching cooking to writing shifted profoundly in 2011 when my first solo book came out. Mm. And now I do still teach cooking classes, but it's primarily in support of the writing. I consider myself, for the most part, a full-time food writer.
What was your first cookbook?
The first one that had only my name on it was called The New Southern Garden Cookbook. Mm-hmm. It came out in April of 2011, and I'm happy to say it's still perking along. People buy that book. They use that book, and that's really the most important part for me. People use that book. I have been, well, all over town, but even in other states where somebody will come and say, are you Sherry Castle? Yes. And they'll say, I have your book, and it never leaves my kitchen counter. And there could not possibly be a better outcome. It's deeply gratifying.
That's a compliment.
It is.
It, really
it is indeed.
And the content of that book is...
Yeah, when you start pitching a book about 3 years before it comes out, so I started trying to define the concept and sell the concept of this book in 2008. And the way the book is organized is atypical, although less unusual now than it was 8 years ago. And instead of organized appetizers through desserts like most books are, this is ordered by the main ingredient, apples mm-hmm. through zucchini. And the premise is that when you cook, you start with something fresh, something that's captured your imagination, or you've picked from the garden or brought home from the farmer's market or gotten in your CSA box. And, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people are familiar with CSAs now, but in 2008, no one knew what I was talking about. So I had to battle both the concept and the organization. But I still think that that serves people well, because whether you go to a farmer's market or have a garden or even just go to the grocery grocery store, we tend to shop for what captures our attention, looks good to us, maybe is on sale. We tend to come home with groceries and then decide what to make. You know, despite all the advice to, you know, have recipes in plan, most people shop with their senses and then decide what to make. And this book, I think, makes it a lot easier to respond to food in that way.
I would think that I'm surprised because I would think that a lot of people do shop by this is what I'm going to make tonight. You know, a chef, that's how we think. We think, oh, we have these ingredients and this is what I'm going to make. That's how I think. I don't know about you.
But I know a lot of people who do exactly
yeah,
what
and
you
I think,
said.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that in being a food writer and stuff like that, you have to have the skills of a chef, the mindset that lets us, you know, convey accurate information, but you also have to have the mindset of your audience, of your home cook. You have to take our professional expertise and construct it in a way that it is relevant and useful to home cooks, because we do approach almost everything differently, but ultimately it's in service of the reader, not the writer.
What do you mean we approach everything differently?
I think just in the way that we look at ingredients and the way that we plan and organize, you know, we tend to do more prep. We tend maybe a little bit more resourceful. I think one of the main differences is we tend to have better pantries. We tend to have more things on hand and so forth. But, you know, there's no one way to write a recipe or a book or anything like that. So I think that it's very important to sing in the right key, so to speak, that, you know, depending on the publication or the audience or something, you have to give the information at a level and in a form that is suitable for that audience, and that's not always the same thing. But I think one of the reasons that I have had some success, shall we say, in my career, especially when I'm helping restaurant chefs write their books, is I feel like I'm a UN translator. I can go from their world to the home world and back and forth in a way that serves everybody the best.
Well, I know that you're a recipe tester, so what does that actually mean?
Well, you know, it can mean a variety of things, and it's usually not what most folks who, you know, aren't in the business would think. I don't just make food and sit around and eat it all day and say, that's either yum or not good or something like that. It's really more of a, it's more robust than that. Sometimes I'll receive a set of recipes and I'm to make it to make sure that there are no glitches, you know, what spots need propped up, where are there actual substantive errors. But what it more often is I'm actually coming up with the recipe. Somebody will say, hey, I need 11 recipes on chicken breasts, and I'll come up with those 11 recipes. And sometimes it's even a step farther back than that. It's like, I need 11 recipes, and I'm the one that decides it's going to be chicken or sweet potatoes or whatever. But it really is more of more authorship than testing a lot of times, where I really am the one that's, you know, filling out that part of a book or a publication or an article. Like, what are these recipes going to be? What are they going to look like? And how are they going to sound?
Well, so I would imagine most people that do not have a background in culinary would be interested to hear how you come up with the idea. If someone just says, I need 30 recipes. You know, that seems daunting. You know, a professional, you're like, okay, now I got to write 30 recipes. Yes.
It is daunting. And, you know, I try to, if I have the luxury of getting more background information on, you know, why did they come to me? What is this client seeking? I'll do that. But I find that now that I've been developing recipes for 20 years, it gets a little easier because I'm not having to reinvent every step. I know that water will always boil. I know that you don't serve raw pasta. I know, you know, there's certain just fundamental principles that are going to hold true. Let me draw an analogy. Each time we get in the car, we don't have to start afresh knowing how to turn it on and which side of the road to drive on. So there are some fundamental things. And then beyond that, quite honestly, I just have a knack for it. I think that it's just something that I can imagine a food in my mind or read a description or see something and sort of taste it in my mind. Like, some people can sight read music. I can sight read food. I can take a bite of something and tell you almost exactly what's in it. And I know that combinations that work, like I'm not going to be putting grapes in chili or some silly thing like that, you know. But I think it's a combination of having an innate ability, kind of a knack for this, and I work really hard at getting better at it.
And practice.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, if you want to cook. At the end of the day, that's the way to get there.
Yep, that's the only way to get there, actually.
There is
no other magic
right.
bullet, I think. You have to just cook. Well, we have to take a quick break. You're listening to Say Yes to the Chef on WCHL 97.9, and we hope you'll be back with us in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Say Yes to the Chef. I am your host, Kelly Taylor, with my co-host, Janice Escott, and our guest today is Sherry Castle. She's a cookbook author, cooking instructor, cookbook everything, recipe writer, food magician.
I wear a lot of hats, I will admit.
We've been talking a little bit about a lot of the things you've been doing with writing, and recipe writing in particular. Why don't you share with us some of your cookbooks? We talked about your first one, the New Southern Garden Cookbook, which has been going strong for 5.5 years.
Right.
But tell us about some of your other cookbooks that you've written.
2 years ago, 2 years and 1 month ago to be precise, I had a book come out called The Southern Living Community Cookbook. And that book is a tribute to community cookbooks, those spiral-bound, community-driven, homegrown cookbooks that people often compile as fundraisers for mm-hmm. the volunteer fire department or the Sunday school class mm-hmm. or some such thing as that. And I did that book for Southern Living Magazine. I used to work for Southern Living and still work with them almost weekly. But the premise of the book was, they said, we want to do a tribute to these community cookbooks. Do you have any thoughts on that? Well, apparently I did, because a week later I had a 75-page book proposal finished.
Wow.
And my decision was, what is going to be the community? Because if you're going to have a community cookbook, you have to have a community, which is not necessarily a map dot. It can be a group of people mm-hmm. coming together for a variety of reasons. One of the defining characteristics of Southern Living, particularly in their earlier decades, was they always included recipes from home cooks. Mm-hmm. So I went through all of the recipes in Southern Living. Yes, I think, so far as we know, I'm the only person that has read everything they've ever printed. Not once, but twice.
Oh, my God.
I read them in order from February 1966 through the end of the year that I was writing the book, and I pulled out great recipes that were submitted by home cooks. And then I had to narrow them down to ones that I thought were delicious, relevant, interesting. So I went from about 45,000 recipes down to 220.
How do you do that?
Well, it's a number of things. I mean, it had to meet that criteria. It had to be relevant. Mm-hmm. It had to be something I thought people would really cook and want to eat. But because I consider myself a food storyteller as much as a cook, perhaps even more as a cook, it has to have some sort of story behind it, either who the cook was, the community that created that recipe, some sort of historical relevance. So it's a delicious compilation of things to eat, but it's also a really interesting thing to read mm-hmm. because it embodied that sense of story and community, just like a community cookbook will. Books are accidental artifacts. They wind up revealing a lot about the people in a specific time and place. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to convey that power, even though it was a cookbook that covered 50 years from cooks all over a region. It still conveyed some sense of who those people were and why they cooked what they did at the time and place that they did.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I like looking at old recipes mm-hmm. and sometimes the ingredients are things I don't even know what they are.
Right.
And you're
right.
Like mm-hmm. my grandma, she used to own a bakery, and I read some of her recipes, and a while ago, when I first started reading them, she would ask for oleo. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what the heck is oleo? Mm-hmm. So I had to call my mom. I was like, what's oleo? Mm-hmm. You know, so it's
right.
just really fascinating how mm-hmm. the ingredients themselves
exactly.
change.
And, you know, when you read from a publication over 50 years, you see ingredients come and go. You see things that were trendy at the time. You can see the introduction of certain small appliances, like when crock pots and microwaves came along. It really is an accidental artifact because they don't know their writing history, but they are because they're responding to what's going on in home kitchens.
It'd be interesting to write a timeline. Do you
actually
went
did
along
that?
With you it, know what? You know, like, oh, here's yeah. crock pot.
I actually did you know. That. Southern Living celebrated their 50th anniversary last year, and I did almost all of the anniversary coverage. And I did that. I wrote a 50-year timeline of food inventions and introductions and benchmarks and things like that. Yeah, I worked on it for months mm-hmm. and months, and boy, did I learn a lot about products and about things. They didn't have the space to use all of it, but I still have it, of course, because I keep everything. I still have that 50-year mm-hmm. timeline and learned a lot. It made me a better cook, a better food writer, and a better conversationalist at boring dinner parties because I can bring up factoids.
So it's Southern Living, but I think that it really applies to Everyone,
oh, absolutely.
Doesn't it?
Oh, it, I mean, it's that's not by any means in, right. You know, specific to Southern. Mm-hmm. That just happened to be the client that right. hired me to do it. But no, you can have that same sort of community mm-hmm. time capsule in any place. Matter of fact, the first community cookbook was done in Philadelphia by a woman in, I think it was in 1864 approximately, by a woman who was raising funds for a Civil War hospital. So, wow. you know, mm-hmm. yeah, community cookbooks are nationwide. There's less evidence that they exist in other countries, but, you know, in all my vast spare time someday, I would love to figure out, is this a phenomenon that's worldwide mm-hmm. or is this pretty much a North American phenomenon?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. It is an interesting question. I'll bet it is in other places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of the things with food. Mm-hmm. I mean, food is sort of like
it's so
this.
Universal.
Yes.
Oh,
I mean, you always find the same types mm-hmm. of recipes, mm-hmm. the same types mm-hmm. of foods. So I bet they have their own. We would find those. And then, Sherry, you can read them all.
Okay.
And then I'll come back.
Another language. Yeah.
And your latest cookbook is Rhubarb.
Rhubarb, yes. A single topic book. It's my first single topic book. And it is on rhubarb, which is something I adore. I absolutely adore rhubarb. And this came out from a collection of books called Short Stack Editions. Mine was number 20 in the series. I think they're up to about 26 or 28 now. Short Stack comes out of Brooklyn, although one of the co-founders actually lives in Raleigh, coincidentally. And each of these volumes are about two dozen recipes that are described as a love letter to an ingredient. And I had other ideas I wanted to do, but someone else had already gotten them. I suggested honey and buttermilk and some others. And then I thought, what do I really love that I don't think anybody else is going to write about? And it was rhubarb. And it is two dozen recipes. And my goal was to share my love for the ingredient and to convince people there's more to rhubarb than pie, and it does not need strawberry as a wingman. And there's a lot that you can do with it. That little book came out in April, and they're darling. They're all hand-bound. They're made out of beautiful paper, very graphically robust and so forth. And the Short Stack editors just came out last month with their first hardback book, the Short Stack Cookbook, and it is not just a repackaging of these smaller volumes. It's all original content, and I have six or eight recipes in that, too. They asked me to develop some recipes, and it's just a coincidence, but it happens that the first one in the entire book is something of mine.
Is it on rhubarb, or do you need
a whole different thing? They did not repeat topics, so I did love a number of different things. I was in the apple chapter, mayonnaise.
Cheese.
Yeah, cool. You know, I can't remember right now, but it was mm-hmm. all fresh content. Yes,
that's mm-hmm. great. Mm-hmm.
It is great. So rhubarb is not just a dessert.
No, it's not, and it's not Southern. You know, as much as I do, mm-hmm. am deeply passionate about Southern, all things Southern food mm-hmm. related, it's not my only gig. I can do other things, too. You mm-hmm. know, I Mediterranean cooking and so forth. So rhubarb is not Southern. It was fun to exercise some different muscles in that way.
We think of it still as Southern.
Well,
I mean rhubarb, maybe because of the pie.
Probably because of the pie. But mm-hmm. if you look at where it grows, it is not a Southern crop by any means. But since I'm from the Mountain South, which has a growing climate of New England, I grew up with it. But it's it doesn't like hot weather, neither do I. So maybe that's why I like rhubarb so much.
My father grew it in Pennsylvania.
Yes, now that would be it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Most of the rhubarb we get in the grocery store, which can actually be quite good, comes out of Canada.
Oh,
mm-hmm. oh
but if you see rhubarb in a grocery store, Alexa, it can be quite good because they purchase so little of it. It tends to be fresh and have mm-hmm. a lot of turnover. So I bet if we walked across the parking lot, we could probably find a grocery store that had a little rhubarb, even though it's the wrong season,
yeah,
the wrong zone.
It's not even the right time of year. But
yeah,
okay.
But we're used to that now. Yeah. I saw asparagus yesterday. I mean, I think that that's both a very good thing and a really a regrettable thing about food is we can get anything from anywhere, and I think that it has made us lose our discernment on what really great seasonal off-the-moment food can be.
That's true. And I think it's odd once you start eating seasonally to eat corn right. in the winter
right.
or it mm-hmm. feels weird after mm-hmm. a while. You're like, oh, this is odd to eat yeah. corn.
Or raspberries or tomatoes mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. those things mm-hmm. that.
Although sometimes, boy, it really hits the spot.
It right. can hit the spot. I mean, it can. And you know, grocery people know that because mm-hmm. you know how we always laugh that the minute 4th of July is over, the Halloween candy's out. And the minute Halloween is over, then everything. Well, I can guarantee you that on January 2nd, the strawberries, those enormous rock hard,
mm-hmm. yes.
kind of red gravel berries, will be there
flavor.
Because they know that people are That's the next thing.
And they
thing.
Travel from who knows where.
Who knows where.
Mm-hmm. You mean for Valentine's Day.
Yeah, but they'll be out January 2nd.
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. we skip things quite quickly
yes,
to the next
do.
Holiday.
We do.
We have to take another quick break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. You're listening to Say Yes to the Chef on WCHL 97.9. Welcome back. This is Say Yes to the Chef. I'm Chef Kelly Taylor with my co-host Janice Escott and my guest Sherry Castle. She's a cookbook author, cooking instructor, southern food expert, recipe writer, ghostwriter.
Many things.
We've been talking about your cookbooks. We haven't mentioned your website, so you might want to give a little shout out so people can look you up and
yes,
see.
Yes, it's sherrycastle.com. And
that's
my
easy.
Sherry is S-H-E-R-I, one R and an I, castle.com. And people can find links to some of the things I've written, and they can find where I'm appearing or speaking or teaching. There's a lot out there. They can see what I look like, for better or
nice
worse, things like that.
So let's talk about Thanksgiving. It's coming up.
It's coming up.
So let's talk about Thanksgiving. What is a Southern Thanksgiving?
Well, the thing is, there is no single Thanksgiving. I've been writing about Thanksgiving a lot lately. And the thing is that if you were to look at any kind of marketing or magazine, you would think that they were all sitting down to the same table, you know, with the turkey, with the this, that, and the other. But we don't. We each express Thanksgiving in very individual terms. It's more of a common concept than a common practice. And I think that is seen most clearly in the South, if not the entire country, in our dressing or stuffing. We can't even agree on what to call it, much less what to do about
true.
It. I think that even more than barbecue, you can get regional differences, hometown loyalties over dressing than you can anything else that Southerners make. If there is any common denominator, it would be cornbread. Mm-hmm. It tends to be a cornbread base, but beyond that, it really can go in any directions. If you're in certain parts of the Delta or around New Orleans and stuff, it's absolutely going to have oysters in it, whereas the rest of us cannot figure out why you would want gray lumps of anything in your dressing. In some places, it's got to be chestnuts, or it must be sausage. Something. And, you know, there's the time from, you know, some people put it in the birds, some people put it in the dish, some people want it almost like a bread salad. Loose and crunchy and herbaceous. And some people, like where my former in-laws lived and stuff, their dressing is the consistency of mashed potatoes. It was like a custard that wouldn't even hold its shape on the spoon. So I think that our commonality is our difference in Thanksgiving rather than the things that are the same everywhere. But it comes down to dressing. You know, people will kind of tolerate different kinds of turkey and maybe different kinds of cranberry, but people I have a longing for home when it comes to their dressing. So my advice is offer all of them.
Yeah,
and plenty of gravy. Gravy can cover up a host of issues, literally and figuratively. So that's good. But, you know, I make a cornbread dressing. I do. I think and probably the reason for that is if the point of dressing had twofold purposes. If you look back at the roots of this, one was to extend the protein, whatever your protein was, back when proteins were hard to come by and expensive and everything, dressing would make that go farther. And the other thing was it used up leftover bread, much like bread pudding or anything else. Well, if you're using up leftover bread and the bread you're most likely to have is cornbread, then it would make sense that that's what's in there. Plus, if you look at it from a culinary point of view, cornbread is a very agreeable medium for any of those textures and shapes and constructions of dressing you have in mind. It can hold its shape and be toasty, almost like a crouton, or it can break apart and go into a custard style without dissolving. If you look at biscuits or sandwich bread or saltine cracker crumbs or any of these things that people might include as part of their dressing, if you used only that, they tend to dissolve and lose their character completely, whereas cornbread is much more agreeable to go along with whatever you have in mind for it.
But then you got to argue first about which cornbread.
Well, and I think that's another one of those universally things on which we disagree. Mm-hmm. People are particular about their cornbread. Mm-hmm. You know, being from the Mountain South, I have a very specific vision of what cornbread should be, which is different from other parts of the South. And I don't think there's a right or a wrong.
What's your cornbread?
My cornbread is always made on demand in a skillet, a 9-inch skillet, not a 10, 11, or 12, 9-inch skillet. Mm-hmm. I use freshly ground cornmeal. Matter of fact, I grind my own cornmeal because I'm like that. To the disgust of some of my fellow mountaineers, put a little flour in mine. Do it because just a little bit, because when you have a very coarse, fresh cornmeal, if you want it to hold together in a way that you can slice as opposed to crumble, it needs a little bit of flour. Mm-hmm. Although I could be, you know, persuaded to leave it out. I use cornbread, the fresh cornmeal, buttermilk. I put a little egg in mine, and I do it in a skillet, and it's one of the few things I still persist in using bacon fat. Mm. I don't use a lot of that in anything else, but I do have bacon fat for the cornbread because I like the crust that it gives. Now, having said all that, I don't make a very crusty cornbread to go in my dressing because I want a different texture and all. But at the end of the day, if somebody said, "What is your favorite meal?" Absolutely, it would involve cornbread because that is the bread of my people. That's our daily bread.
Mm-hmm. So if someone didn't want to use the bacon fat, what would the substitute be?
Well, the thing is you can use, I recommend half butter and half oil because butter's going to give you flavor, but it scorches easily. Mm-hmm. Oil will give you that smoke point, but not a lot of flavor. The thing is that those of us that use bacon fat in our skillet, you make that skillet screaming hot and you put the fat in, and the fat is, you know, well over 400 degrees. Mm-hmm. So when you put the batter, it sizzles like frying a hush puppy or something and gives that crisp crust. You can't do that with the butter and oil thing. You just can't do that preheating, so you're not going to get that crust.
It would burn
absolutely. Right. Mm-hmm. But I tell people that, you know, a little bit of good bacon fat can be like a tincture. A tiny bit of the real thing can go a long way. Mm-hmm. So when my dad was trying to adjust the kinds of fats that he cooks and eats, I will make him a combination of oil and a little bacon fat, and the whole thing tastes that way. You still couldn't do the preheating, but you can get that flavor and so forth. So, you know, there's a difference in the cornbread I'm going to eat and the cornbread I'm going to use as an ingredient.
What other ingredients do you put into your dressing?
In my dressing, there's quite a bit of onion and celery. I put some fresh apple in mine, chestnuts or pecans if I can't get the chestnuts. I use fresh sage and fresh thyme. And one thing that is the backbone of all of my Thanksgiving cooking is I'm obsessed with stock. I think that a lot of people's recipes, whatever they are, could be improved by simply making good stock, either turkey or chicken, to go into it. Mm-hmm. I have started my stock already. I start my stock around October and work on it in series until it's incredibly intensely flavored, and I freeze it and so forth. And I would say that if there was one lesson I could have people take home or bring to the kitchen for Thanksgiving, it would be take a few minutes to make good stock and everything it touches will be improved.
Stock makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. It really does.
It does.
And it's so versatile.
It is.
As you say, you can put it into your dressing, but you also, gravy.
Right.
And it's an essential ingredient to gravy.
It is. And, you know, people, really a lot of times, you know, gravy intimidates people. And I think part of it is the last minute requirement of it. Well, you can actually make some really delicious gravy in advance that you can reheat if you have good stock. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can be, I've got that. There's a magazine called The Local Palate that some people know. And I actually have a cover story this time. It says on the cover of a magazine, this blows my mind, Sherry Castle's Thanksgiving. And I give and that can be found online too, a lot of directions on how do you make good stock and how can you make gravy up to 3 days ahead. So all you have to do is rewarm it rather than hyperventilate right before going to the table.
It probably tastes so much better being made 3 days before.
It really does, but it all comes down to that stock and so forth. But some of my friends call me the gravy whisperer. I really take great pride in gravy of all kinds, and this is one I was willing to put my name on that was made in advance. It's good stuff.
Well, any quick tips? We have about 45 seconds.
Yes, there is a product called Shake and Blend or Wondra. It is a quick mixing flour that is in every grocery store, but people don't know to look for it. It is a flour specifically designed for making sauces and gravies, and it is transformative. Everybody today needs to go buy some Wondra or some Shake and Blend.
Get some stock.
If they only knew, exactly.
So shake and blend or wonder.
Or wonder.
Right. But it you cannot make it lump. So a lot of times the intimidation people have is it's going to be lump or something. Yum. You can't make it lump. And it's a magic ingredient. It will solve a host of problems for $3. How many of our problems can be solved at all, much less for
$3? Yeah. That's a really good idea. Well, that's the tip of the day.
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, we have to take another break. You're listening to Say Yes to the Chef with our guest Sherry Castle today. And this is WCHL 97.9. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. This is Say Yes to the Chef. I am Kelly Taylor with Janice Escott, my co-host, and our guest, Sherry Castle, cookbook author, cooking instructor, a recipe writer, etc. And before we left for the break, we were talking about gravy as an intimidating factor at the Thanksgiving meal because of its last-minuteness and the your advice about using Wandra. And that's a great tip. I don't use it, but I'll have to go look at it. What other tips can you give for people who are intimidated in particular about their turkey, making the turkey, the big star of the table?
The big star of the table. Well, first of all, I would say that unless someone needs a Norman Rockwell moment where they want this bronze bird brought out to explore all the different configurations in which you can get turkey now. You know, you can get turkey breasts. You can get turkey parts if you want only the dark meat. You can get boneless. You can get little fillets. You can get cutlets. There's lots of different ways to get turkey that make it less intimidating to cook. Because let's face it, most people do not bring an object any larger than a turkey into their home all year.
Right.
But if you have a small family, you can get turkey breast halves that look like bone-in chicken breasts. They're just larger, that cook in about 30 minutes. There's lots of different ways to cook the turkey. I would say also that no matter which of the cuts you choose, everyone needs an instant read thermometer, because there's all these anecdotes and, you know, advice and old cookbooks and stuff. But the only true thing is what a thermometer will tell you. And people, I believe, way too often overcook their turkey because they're terrified it's not going to be done.
That's true.
Opinions can vary, but a temperature is a ironclad thing to rely on. And by an instant read thermometer, it does not have to be expensive. It doesn't have to be radio controlled. It doesn't have to hook to your iPhone. You can get one for a couple of bucks that will tell you. Do not rely on the so-called pop-up thermometer that's in these birds. The way these things work is there is a heat responsive adhesive in them. The, in theory, when that adhesive gets to a certain temperature, it liquefies and it releases a spring and that little thing pops up. The truth is there can be as much as 25 degrees in accuracy. So
wow,
if you think about
huge.
Over
that is huge.
So if you are aiming for 165 on a turkey and you're up or, you know, high or off, low, either one by 25 degrees, that's not a good outcome.
Mm-mm.
So get a real thermometer, insert it into the thickest part of the meat of whatever cut you have. If you are using a cut with a bone, make sure the tip of the probe doesn't touch that bone.
Mm-hmm.
And remember that the larger the turkey, like if you do have a whole turkey that weighs 16 to 18 pounds, it will be so hot when it comes out of the oven, it will continue to cook as it rests for a few more minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So the larger the turkey, the more time it needs to rest. And remember, it's going to continue cook and rise about another 5 degrees before it's time to carve it.
Mm-hmm.
That resting time is incredibly important. When proteins cook, they curl up like a phone cord. And you do realize we're the last generation that knows what that looks like. But anyway, it curls up. And when in that resting, a lot of that tightness relaxes and you're going to have more juice in that bird than running all over the countertop and so forth. So, you know, buy a thermometer, no matter your cut, no matter your technique, even if you're deep frying, that thermometer is going to tell you the truth and it's going to give you peace of mind in a much better bird.
I think that is the secret.
It is. Definitely.
It really is a thermometer because I think that just alleviates all the questioning and the concern that the cook has.
Exactly.
I mean, what a nightmare to bring the bird to the table and it's undercooked, right?
So, but I will say that if, heaven forbid, that happens, do not try to put a bird that has come out of the oven and has rested and been transferred to a platter back in the oven. Go ahead at that point and cut it into smaller pieces and reheat each of, or continue cooking those pieces individually, mm-hmm. Because it's that. That turkey has left the barn. If you have got the whole thing out of the oven and everything, don't try to reheat the whole thing because it will go from bad to worse.
So the, mm-hmm. the 165 degrees, is that the temperature that you are gearing up for and then the resting time after that? Or do you want it to be less than
that? You want a little bit less than that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for people that still, despite all of our suggestions, mm-hmm. they use thermometers, one thing to remember about poultry is you may have, especially if you have a young turkey or an heirloom turkey or something, they used to say there should be no trace of pink. Those birds, because of what they're fed and their age and so forth, can sometimes have a slightly pink or rosy hue to the meat that touches the bone. Don't let that panic you. I mean, you know the difference between raw meat and a rosy hue. Mm-hmm. But the juices that run from it should show no traces of pink. So instead of obsessing over, you know, the color of the meat, look at your juices. And if you need a backup visual cue in addition to the data you're getting from the thermometer, look at those juices. And if they are golden, they often call it running clear. Well, they're never clear. They're always golden. Right. There should be no mm-hmm. traces of pink. And that can reassure people. Follow more modern advice that is found in any website, any cooking hotline or anything. Don't look at the advice that your grandma, we used to say to cook turkeys like 185, 195 and stuff like that. They're going to be ruined. Mm-hmm. So you need to do right by this bird. Get a thermometer. Aim for that 165 serving temperature. And, you know, another thing you do when I said, you know, you go ahead and cut it apart and reheat it. If you want to make turkey a little bit ahead, to free up your oven for, you know, side dishes or something after it's rested, or especially if you're choosing a turkey breast, you can go ahead and cut that meat off and make it into some slices and put it in a shallow baking dish with a little bit of your delicious turkey stock and let that be your warming medium and the thing that keeps it moist. That can be a really great way to get your turkey out of the way maybe an hour before you plan your meal so it can rest. You've got that carved. You've got that ready to go. You could even do that if you're serving a large number of guests, you know, and you need more turkey, cook a turkey breast or two on the side, have it ready, put it in your warm stock so it's moist and delicious, and you can supplement that one bird.
Especially for the breast, which
especially
can get dry.
For the mm-hmm. breast, exactly, which is what most people still choose. Mm-hmm. It is. Mm-hmm. When you're making that stock that we were talking about earlier, this is the time of year because so many people purchase turkey breast that you can get turkey parts for almost no money, and so you can buy the leg and the wings and the things like that to make your delicious stock for a couple of dollars a pound. It's probably the best bargain in a grocery store right now are those parts.
And it makes the most delicious ingredient.
Right. The more bone that you have, the better your stock is mm-hmm. going to be because bones lend flavor. And if you really cook a good stock and so forth, those bones will have released enough natural gelatin, which is where gelatin comes from, that it will congeal in the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. If you can slice your stock, you have done a good thing.
Uh-huh. And that's about cooking it down a little as well as you can use the feet. You can use everything.
You can use everything. Exactly. Exactly.
Which grossed people out, but
it's part of that. Just no matter what part you use, I would say that when you have it, how do you know when done is done? It should taste like turkey soup.
Yes.
And if it doesn't taste like turkey soup, your stock isn't finished. And that's going to help your bird and your stuffing and your gravy and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when we do gravy at our house, we'll take all the whatever's left in the bottom of the pan and scrape that in and throw it into the blender or food processor and then put that with the gravy and it makes an absolutely delicious gravy.
It does. I use vegetables. I use carrot, mainly onion, but a little carrot and celery is a vegetable roasting rack under my turkey.
Lovely.
And of course, those vegetables just cook to this delicious caramelized mush. And I, too, will puree that and add it to the gravy, and the flavor is amazing.
It is amazing.
I find that those vegetables, not only the flavor, but it keeps those drippings from scorching, you know, as they drip down. It's a great collection device that you can then eat, and it will add wonderful body and things. Mm-hmm. I also tend to put about a tablespoon of some sort of like sherry or brandy or bourbon in the end of the gravy, just a little bit at the end, kind of lifts everything up, and it's a delicious addition.
Wow. Let's quickly mention your classes at a Southern Season.
I still teach at a Southern Season, which is right down the hall from where we're sitting right now. I teach there twice a month, every month, plus an occasional special event. You can go either to the Southern Season website or to my website and see what those classes are. They're on a variety of topics. I teach most of their Southern. I teach most of their Italian and Spanish. Sometimes I'll do a topic like cast iron cooking, but we have a wonderful time. It's a good time.
It's great fun. It really is.
It is.
Sherry is one of the best.
Thank you.
So thank you very, very much, Sherry. It's been delightful having you here.
Haven't we had a good time?
Thank you so much
for including me on my favorite holiday of the year.
Please like us on our Facebook page, Yes to the Chef. And we're co-hosts Kelly Taylor, natural chef and instructor, and Janice Escott, culinary chef and instructor. Happy cooking, Kelly.
Happy cooking.
Happy
cooking.
Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Sherry.
Thank you. He's got your Toradora. Oh, Dora. Try the bologna, Tony. Hey, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I'll fix your favorite dishes. Hoping this good food will fill you. Stay in the kitchen alone, work my fingers.